Welcome to Red Inca. I'm Jared Kimber. This week on Red Inca, we talk about life on the T20 circuit with a man who has done plenty of it.
My name is David Visser. I'm a professional cricketer. I've been playing cricket professionally for the last 15 years. Currently play on the franchise circuit, which means I play for different teams all over the world. And I am just released a podcast called Hitman for Hire, which documents a year in my life playing all the franchise tournaments.
We talk about coming from a small town, work-life balance, playing for South Africa, being a coal pack, Namibia, death bowling, chopping wood, and why his four-year-old daughter likes business class. Okay, so let's start with that. I think one of the most interesting points is I did the franchise circuit for about a year and a half, and you know I've got wife and kids and all those sorts of things. It's not a normal life, and it's not even a normal life for cricketers, right? You know, it's not the 6 months mostly spending time at home and then maybe doing a little bit of touring in the off season. It's a completely different world. How do you handle your work-life balance with something like that?
Yeah, it is a unique landscape that we've found ourselves in with all of these franchise tournaments. You know, like you said, it used to be back in the day, 6 months you play, it's your home season, and then you maybe pick up one, maybe two franchise tournaments throughout your off-season just to stay busy. Or guys just used to go play club cricket in the UK or in Australia, depending which season you were playing in. But you know, the advent of the franchise system has changed the landscape of the game now, and you could play 12 years, you know, or 12 months around the year. There's no off season anymore, so it is a fine balancing act, especially for someone, you know, like myself. I've got a young family, and it's tough to be away from them the whole time. And you know, people quite often see the glitz and the glamour of the franchise tournament. You know, the IPL has been one to glamorize, you know, combining cricket with Bollywood, and you know, the Bollywood actors are the owners, and it looks like a bold glitz of glamour, but people don't actually know the intricacies that go on behind the scenes, you know, how much time it is spending away from your family, and you know, the sacrifices you have to make, you know, being a franchise cricketer and being away from your family the whole time. I mean, if I just take myself last year, I left home on the 4th of January and returned on the 26th of August. That was the first time I was back at home, and that was just constantly traveling the whole time. So fortunately for me, I've got a young family, so they could come out and visit me, and we kind of, you know, flew them out to all the different tournaments so they can also experience that. But it is difficult, and, you know, it gets a bit tough after a while.
How old are your kids?
They are 4 and 2. So fortunately, they're still quite young. You know, we can take them out of school, and they don't miss out on too much. And, you know, for them, I see, you know, going overseas, going to countries as India, Dubai, the UK, you know, that's just as much of their learning experience what they would have at school. So, you know, I still feel like that benefits them also. It's just... it gets a bit tough when you've got to book their own flights and everyone gets over. It's actually quite funny. My daughter is 4 years old. She's been fortunate enough to have a couple of business class flights in her life. And then the last time when we flew to Abu Dhabi for the T10, you know, that's only an 8-hour flight. So she had an economy class flight. And as we get on there, she turns to her mom and says, "Mommy, where's my bed?" So she's definitely... used to a different standard of living than what we are at this stage. So that was actually quite a funny moment.
I've had similar things with my kids. In fact, I was offered business class at one stage, and I asked for the cash difference.
Yeah.
And my son was like, why don't we go business class? And I said, because if you go business class when you're 8, when you're 12, I may never be able to afford this again.
Exactly.
And the other thing with the travel is it's really easy when they're 4 and 2. Because, you know, you don't have to worry as much about, you know, in-depth school stuff. As they get older, it gets harder and harder to travel with them. And then you've got, you know, their school holidays, but you might have a finals or something quite 100%. Important on at that time. Work all that out. It is not a normal existence.
No, so I still, you know, I've said quite a bit that if I didn't have children so late in my career, I probably wouldn't be doing what I am at the moment. If my kids were a little bit older, there's no ways I could just, you know, to take them out of school, or I could be gone for 2 months at a time and not see them and expect everything to be okay. I mean, you know, I'm fortunate that, you know, we did only start having kids a little bit older in life because of my lifestyle. And, you know, now that my kids are getting a little bit older, even though my eldest is only 4, it's already getting tough to leave. And, you know, when they get to the proper school going age, there's no ways you can have that instability in their life that you just take them in and out the whole time. So, you know, I'm fortunate that we did it that way, but it's getting a bit tough now to leave every single time. My daughter thinks if she doesn't say goodbye to me, then I'm not going to leave. So she just flat out doesn't say goodbye when I leave, thinking that I wouldn't go then. Shame.
Yeah, no, up until COVID, I was traveling everywhere, whether it was be with franchises or, you know, doing commentary gigs. So, I remember all that missing my older son's first birthday and all that sort of stuff. It's very, very tough. Let's go back to you as a cricketer. You are obviously an all-rounder, and I was looking at a piece that CS Chimwanza did with you, and he was talking about how a big part of it was that you were quite a restless child. Obviously not as much business class seats when you were a child coming through. How did that sort of being a restless child transform to cricket? How did the two sort of go together?
Yeah, I think, like most people growing up in South Africa, all you want to do is be outdoors the whole day. The weather's awesome, yeah. So, you're always just outdoors, straight off to school, you're outside, you're doing as many sports as you possibly can. I mean, I remember growing up, I played cricket, rugby, hockey, squash, tennis, golf, anything that just had a ball and something that you can hit that ball with, we were busy with. And, it used to be you go to school, straight off to school, you would have some sort of sport, whether it be rugby in the winter or cricket in the summer, athletics at the start of the year. And then as soon as that's finished, you go back home. And then, I grew up in quite a small town, so everybody would just be in the street and you'll just be playing whatever sport it is then. So, it was always a case of being outside and playing about. And, I look at the youth nowadays, everybody's sitting in front of the Xbox and PlayStation. And, that just never featured for us. We were just always outdoor kids and just playing whatever sport we could. And, obviously then as you get older, you start enjoying a couple more sports more than the other ones. You start getting better at other sports and, and then just you've got to try and almost figure out what you're going to do or which sport you want to focus on. But for me, as growing up, I had an older brother also, so there was always somebody to play that sport with and to compete against, essentially. So, it was just all about playing as much sport as we possibly could.
And when does cricket become? Because, you've got a body that maybe not quite a rugby body, not by South African standards, but you are a bigger guy for cricket. So was it rugby and cricket that you sort of ended up in at the end, or was there another sport that was pulling you?
No, so it was actually funny. Up until I was 16, I was the smallest guy about. I didn't hit puberty until a later age. I was the shortest guy about. And then all of a sudden, within 2 years, I shot up to 6'3". And I was actually still at school when I played my final year at school, I was still a spin bowler because I still had this mentality of being the shorter guy. So I still bowled spin and just batted a bit. So, it was for me, it was always cricket, and tennis was the other one that I really enjoyed. Played a lot of tennis when I was younger, which then correlated into squash when I was a little bit older. But cricket was the one that I enjoyed the most and probably excelled the most then also. But again, coming from a small town, I was always like the big fish in a small pond. And then when I went to university, that changed completely. And then all of a sudden, things get a bit busier, a bit more hectic. And, when I got to university, the first day I was training there, they stuck me in the fourth team. And I was like, whoa, okay, this is a bit of a wake-up call. And then that dream to play professional cricket kind of just took a step aside. And then I just played club cricket and studied for a little bit. And then things just kind of got lucky and snowballed a bit for me. And I eventually picked it up as professional again after a couple of years.
So just talk to me about that point. Is that because you were still physically developing? Like, are you not bowling all that fast at that stage? Or is your batting not come along? Like, why is it that you were sort of not a professional level cricketer at that point? I know it's hard in South Africa because there's so many, Colin Ingram was someone who kind of retired from, he went from underage cricket and then went to university and was going to give it up. So there's a lot of very talented cricketers who around the age of 20, 21, 22 sort of slipped back out of the system in South Africa. But were you not good enough, or was it you just hadn't completely developed your game to get to that level at that point?
No, I think if I had to be blatantly honest, I wasn't good enough at that stage. That could be a combination of, coming from a smaller town, so not having as much opportunities, being a lot smaller then, and then going quickly. I remember I only started bowling a pace bowler because I was training in the nets for a club cricket game and the guys kept whacking me out of the nets the whole time and I got annoyed about it. So I just went to go fetch my ball, ran in and bounced the guy and hit him on the head. And then the coach saw me do that and he said, "Can you do that again?" So I was like, "Well, I'll give it a go." And I bounced him again and I gloved him off. And they were like, "Okay, well, you're opening the bowling on Saturday." And from that moment, that is when things kind of changed for me, because then I wasn't just a spin bowler who could bat a little bit. Now I became an actual all-rounder. And then things, you know, snowballed for me from there. So
how old were you when you did that? How old
that was, I was that? 20 when that happened.
Okay, so that, I mean, that's really late, isn't it?
Yeah, so, and I think that also was, you know, is a contributing factor to the fact that I haven't had injuries as a bowler. If you look at a lot of other bowlers, they've had multiple stress fractures, you know, a lot of, you know, bowling injuries. But I think because I started a lot later, my body was possibly already developed by the time I, you know, did this bowling motion, which is a very unnatural motion for your body. So because my body was already developed by the time I started doing that, I haven't picked up as many injuries and, you know, stress fracture related injuries or what other bowlers have, which probably a blessing for me starting so late. But yeah, I think you can just put it down to the fact that I probably wasn't good enough at that stage. Never played like SA under 19s, was never part of the system or anything like that. I just kind of enjoyed the game and just kept on playing and kept going at it, and then got, I think, you know, obviously when I started bowling pace, that changed things a little bit, and then just got a couple of opportunities and a couple of injuries that other people got gave me a chance to come into a team, and then, you know, we're sitting 15 years down the line, I suppose. So it's funny how things work out.
You kind of went, though, from someone who wasn't in the system to someone who kind of was not hyped as the next big thing, but certainly from a domestic point of view, there were multiple teams who suddenly wanted you. So it's a weird place. You, from the small town, you end up at college, no one's that interested in you, you're a club cricketer. And then not long after that, I think it was the Lions and the Titans suddenly, you know, are like, oh, wait, he can bowl yeah, fast, and he's big, and he can whack him. You know, how do we get him in? How does that sort of affect your mentality? Because you were almost on the way out of cricket, you know, out of that system. And then suddenly, like, everyone's telling you how great you are.
Yeah, so the only reason why I actually got those contract offers was I played in the, my last year of studies, I decided, you know, I'm going to just go play in the universities week. And we actually ended up winning the universities week, and I was the player of the tournament. And at that stage, the player of the tournament got automatic entry into the National Academy the following season. So then I was in the National Academy, a 22-year-old amongst 18-year-olds in the National Academy. And Ray Jennings was the coach of the National Academy, and I did well at the National Academy, scored a 100, got a couple of fifers. And he was then part of the Lions setup also, and he got in touch with Lions saying, listen, you need to sign this guy. And then when the Titans heard that, I'd done one or two like winter squad training with them, but never played any games for them. And then when they heard that, they were like, well, you know, maybe we should, you know, look at this guy also. And then they offered me a contract. But I remember, it's actually funny, I remember thinking to myself when I signed my first two-year deal with the Titans, I was like, well, you know, nice two-year deal. Just go enjoy those 2 years. And then, you know, when the 2 years is finished, you can go work. And, you know, I was a qualified auditor. So, you know, you just go enjoy your 2 years, you know, take it all in. And then, you know, when you're done, you can go be an auditor. And that was my attitude towards cricket at that stage. It was like, well, it's not something that you're going to do for long. So just go enjoy your 2 years. You know, you're getting paid to play cricket and go enjoy it. And then after that, you can go work. And I think that not putting that pressure on myself possibly, you know, benefited me in the long run.
So 2007-08 is that your first sort of breakthrough year? Yep. Is that when it, yeah.
2008 was when I went to the National Academy and then breakthrough after that, yeah.
Yeah, so you start playing T20 cricket in what, March 2008? I've got the numbers up here. So for how long into this before you start to think, well, I could play for South Africa here, like, because you would still have that small town, you know, casual vibe, as you said, the 2 years. So how long into it are you then suddenly saying to myself, wait a minute, like I could actually play at the next level?
To be honest with you, the thought never, ever crossed my mind. It was still a shock because I never, even though I was playing for the Titans from 2008, I made my debut, but it was only really 2010 I started featuring most games in most formats. So I did like my 2 years there where I was in the squads, but carrying drinks in and out the whole time. And then from 2010 onwards, I kind of featured for most of the games. But I was never called up to any emerging tour or any South African A tour or anything like that. And so I never thought I was that close. I mean, the thought never, obviously you dream of playing for South Africa, but I never thought that it would happen. And then I still remember I was in 2013, I was at a training session. It was a winter training session with the Titans, and the Titans coach just called me over towards before training and said, listen, you're going to get a coach from Russell. You're going to get a call from Russell Domingo, who is a South African coach at that stage. And but I just wanted to tell you first, congratulations, you've been selected for the T20 side. And I was like, what? Like, are you serious? It's like, yeah, you're going to Sri Lanka, you've been selected in the T20 side. And I was totally, like, literally speechless. I couldn't say anything because it was so far off my radar. I didn't even think I was that close to it. And, you know, and again, I don't know if that was just me just being too chilled about it or, you know, always, you know, I've always been someone who maybe, like, underplays my abilities or, you know, doesn't have that full-on confidence of what you're doing. But I still, like, to this day, I couldn't believe at that stage that I got chosen, you know, to play for Platea. It was just a complete shock to me.
This is brought to you by Cricket 8. They are a new player in the game trying to educate fans on what is really happening in cricket. We have a partnership with them where we host live watch-alongs, do podcasts and write articles. If you want to know what is really happening with our game, visit cricket8.com. So from 2013 to 2016, you're kind of in that international setup. Yeah. You know, you eventually start playing one days as well, I think maybe towards 2015, 2016. You do that for a few years and then you sign a Colpack deal. Now, I mean, I know why this is but most fans don't. Most fans kind of see it in the wrong way. It's about financial stability because if you are in the best eight players in South Africa, a Colpack deal is good, but not the most important thing. But if you're in the 8th to 20th best players in South Africa, the Colpack money is just so much higher. And also, you know what your future is, right? You're not worried that you might get injured or anything. Like, you've got a long-term contract and you will be looked after. But it's still a tough call because you're still right in that mix. Mm-hmm. So that's emotionally, that must be a tough decision to make.
Yeah, so... Now, for me, it was 100% just the whole security for the family thing. You know, there was a lot made of it at that time, especially with Carl Abbott and Mladen Rousseau, who signed Colpack just at the same time as me. And everybody always puts it down to, you know, there's this whole thing in South Africa about, you know, the equality and the quota system and guys not getting opportunity and all of that. And, you know, I can't speak for other people, but for me, that was not an issue at all. You know, that wasn't the reason why I signed Colpack or anything, you know. I actually had to pull out of the Platea side. I'd been selected for T20 series and then I had to pull out because I had already signed Colpack. So it wasn't like I wasn't getting the opportunity or anything. Mm. The main thing for me was, yes, it was the financial stability. I played for Sussex as an overseas the year before that and I really enjoyed my time there. And as a player, just in that short 2 months I was there, I felt like I grew quite a bit. So, you know, I was quite excited to see what the future would hold with that. The other main reason for me was, I featured in all of the T20 squads, but I'd kind of been in and out of the ODI squads, been left out of the ODI squad, and then, you know, other guys came through. Dwayne Tutuola started playing, and Andile Pefakwaya started playing, and they were all, you know, we were all competing for one spot. And I just felt like I'd fallen out of favor in the ODI side. And just being in the T20 side, then we just played the 2016 World Cup, so there wasn't a lot of T20 cricket happening for the next 2 years. It just seemed like the right time for me to go try something different and to develop my game. And that was the main thing, is that, you know, I thought to myself, okay, I'll go sign Colpack, I'll play for Sussex in the winter, and then in the summer I'll be available to play in two or three of the franchise leagues, and, you know, it'll be this great thing for me. And, you know, it didn't quite work out that way for me at the start of it.
I mean, it's interesting because most teams in the world don't have that sort of, don't have so many options as fast bowling all-rounders, like as seam bowling all-rounders. Like, there's not a logjam of most teams. Like, if you have a look, like, Australia's just had this incredible run where they've got Cameron Green and, you know, maybe got Will Sutherland and Aaron Hardy all coming through at the same time. But for years, you could have walked into Australian sides because they didn't have, you know, that player available. And, you know, there are many other countries, you know, places like Sri Lanka and India who are desperate for that. But in South Africa, That's almost like the main thing that, you know, that the country has produced from Jimmy Sinclair all the way through to Callis. There's always been this. So it does mean that you're always in a position where there's going to be another guy who's going to come in and be able to do those sorts of things. Is that in the back of your mind as well? So you're already fighting with the two guys, and Dilly and Dwayne, but are you also thinking 2-3 years ahead? I'm not in the test side. I haven't played any test cricket, despite the fact my first class record's okay. If you can't get at least two regular South African, be a regular in two South African teams, you know, the financial benefits are not, it's not as sustainable, right?
No, not at all. And I think, you know, if I had maybe signed a Cricket South Africa contract, That might have, you know, if I was contracted by them financially, that would have been a lot better than just the normal Titans franchise contract that I had at that stage. And that might have, you know, possibly swayed me to not sign Colpack at that stage. But, you know, like I said, for me, you'd never have that crystal ball. And, you know, people often say to me, you know, I only played 26 games for South Africa. You know, if you didn't sign Colpack, would you have maybe played tests? Would you have maybe played more ODIs? You know, Andile played over 100 ODIs. Dwayne played, you know, also a whole lot of white ball cricket and a couple of tests for South Africa. Would you maybe have done that? And now I don't have that crystal ball, but I honestly feel that I'm a lot better player now than what I was back then because I'd signed Colpack, because I got the opportunity to play in all of these franchise tournaments. So, you know, sitting right here, I could say, yeah, I'm good enough now to play all of that stuff. But if I had never signed those deals and never taken the path that I did, I possibly would be retired right now because I wouldn't have, you know, had all those opportunities. So there's no, I've got no regrets or anything with the way that I did things. Yes, I would have loved to have played more for South Africa. Yes, our ultimate dream was to play a test match. But, you know, for the career that I've had, I can't really complain. You know, I've had it a lot better than a lot of other people have.
So 2017 sort of into 2018, you're kind of a Sussex player who occasionally goes off. There's not, I'm just having a look, there's not a lot of franchise cricket being played in your record there. Then 2018-19, you go to the BPL. That seems to be the point at where, you know, people like me knew who you were before, but that's the sort of point when you sort of enter the sort of that franchise circuit. So how did the BPL gig happen and how did that affect your career?
So, you know, like I said, when I signed Colpack for Sussex, my great big thing was I was going to play 6 months in the UK and I was going to play all the franchise tournaments and, you know, it was going to be all this happy days and whatever. And then 2017 came along and it was the worst season I had of my life. I had a stinkover season for Sussex. I couldn't score any runs. I got left out of the T20 side. It was a tough year. And that was actually the first time that I almost started questioning myself. Like, did I make the right decision? Maybe I should just go back and play for the Titans and, you know, maybe I should retire. You know, I'm not good enough for this. But, you know, fortunately, a little bit of sense came to my mind and then I kept on going. But that was also the time where I kind of started thinking to myself, okay, I need to change my game a little bit. And, you know, it's not a secret that the way I bat and my batting stance and the way I go about things is a little bit different. It's unique to the way that I play the game. And that is when it all came along.
A little bit wood choppery.
Yeah, a little bit baseballish, clubby, like it just, you know, but that was that period where I was like, listen, I need to do something now. I need to change my way that I play. Otherwise, I'm not going to feature anymore. And so I went in and did a lot of, you know, watched videos, did a bit of research on swing techniques and all of that stuff. And then, you know, fortunately, I got that opportunity in the BPL where I think somebody got injured and I came away as a replacement, came in as a replacement player. And then Mahela, Jay Wadeen, was the batting coach there. So I got to work with him a little bit. And then I did well there. And then suddenly the PSL came along where I was a replacement over there. And then I did well in the PSL. And then it just, you know, once you start doing well in those franchise circuits, it's just a snowball effect. But, you know, also in saying that, I don't think if I didn't go and spend a bit of time on my game and, you know, almost reinvent myself as the type of hitter that I am now, I probably wouldn't have done well in those opportunities. I wouldn't be here. So, you know, 2017, 2018 there was an important part of my career just purely because I had to just go back and you know, reinvent the wheel and just hope that I get that opportunity to show it. And, you know, fortunately for me, when I got the opportunity in Bangladesh, it went well for me.
I mean, you won't want this reminder, but I'll say it for the listeners. you averaged 15 in T20 cricket over more than 40 games in 2017, 2018 with a strike rate of about 112. So anyone knows who you are now, they'd be like, what? Those numbers don't make any sense. So the Bangladesh thing happens and then you become the franchise player. When does Namibia come? I mean, you know, we've talked a lot about South Africa. I know you have Namibian heritage. You know, Namibia's rise sort of, you know, that sort of early 2000s, you know, 2003 World Cup they're involved in. But there isn't as much hype. You know, Kenya is kind of the other major African team for a long period there. When does Namibia first get in touch and go, wait a minute, can you play for us?
So they actually got in touch with me late 2000s already, like 2009, maybe early 2010, around about there. At that stage, Namibia was still actually playing in the semi-professional competition in South Africa. So yeah. I played against Namibia a few times when I played for Easterns, which was a semi-professional team that I played for back then. And, you know, chatting to some of the guys there, they found out that I had a Namibian heritage and my dad was born there and I could get a Namibian passport. So the talks already happened then. And then I got chosen for South Africa, and now that means you've got to wait 4 years before you can go back and play for Namibia again. And that also kind of coincided. There was a bit of a fall of Namibia. They kind of fell away for a little while and lost their ODI status. And, you know, a lot of hard work had been done after that to get that ODI status back again. But, you know, the idea of playing for Namibia had never crossed my mind again after I played for South Africa. I never thought it would happen. And when I signed Colpack, I kind of retired from international cricket, as you have to if you sign Colpack. And in my mind, I never thought I'd play international cricket again. For me, it was done. I never thought to myself, you know, let's, even when the Brexit happened and Colpack was going to get dissolved, I never thought to myself, let's go back to South Africa and play for South Africa, anything like that. My international career was done. For me, it was finished. And then just out of the blue, Albie Morkel phoned me up the one day. And I mean, I played with Albie at the Titans for years, and, you know, we've known each other for a long time. And he just phoned me up and said, listen, how about we just resurrect your international career again? And I was like, no, what are you talking about? Like, well, I'm assistant coach for Namibia now. They've just qualified for the T20 World Cup. We know you've got all the paperwork in place. We want you to come play for Namibia. And as soon as he said that, the thought never even like crossed my mind. But as soon as he said it, I just jumped on it immediately. I was like, yes, let's do it. I was excited for it. It was a new challenge for me again. You know, and I saw it as if I could do well for Namibia on an international stage, you know, possibly that could even lift my profile even more when it comes to the franchise tournaments. And also, you know, it's always nice when you go and play for a team and you kind of like feel like you wanted, you know, you like you go there and they want you to be there and you know, they really make you feel welcome. And as soon as I stepped into that Namibian change room, all the guys were so welcoming. They, you know, they're really a nice bunch of guys. And it just, I was surprised how quickly I felt at home over there. And, you know, I still maintain that if I didn't play for Namibia, I probably wouldn't have got that IPL contract that I got last year, because I still feel that, you know, most of the time, if you want to play in the IPL, you've got to be featuring in international cricket. You know, you can do well in the franchises and maybe you'll get picked up, but if you're doing well in international cricket, then you've got a better chance of getting picked up in the IPL. And, you know, ultimately, if I didn't go back and play for Namibia, I probably wouldn't have gotten that opportunity again.
Also, you know, because of the kind of style that you play, you're like generally the fifth bowler and you're the sixth or seventh batter, right? Like you need really smart analysts and coaches to notice that and realize where it fits in. Whereas when you're playing for Namibia, like, you know, when those games are being broadcast, the commentators are spending a lot of time going, well, Namibia is batting quite slow here, but David Visa will be coming in later, right? And when you're taking the new ball, you're bowling a little bit more like a strike bowler at times. So naturally, you know, we see it with Sikander Raza as well. Like, there's an elevation of your roles, whereas, you know, you and Sikander Raza are more supplementary players for franchise teams. You know, you and I know what your worth is, and you should be higher than that. But everyone looks at opening batters and opening bowlers and the gun spin bowlers, right? Like, exactly. So it's very different. So suddenly, everyone's talking about your name at that point, and you really do go from what we would call on you know, cricket Twitter, like a hipster choice, to suddenly a bit of a star for that, you know, year and a half period.
Yeah, so, you know, like you say, the position that I used to play in, you always just have these small impacts in the game. You're not really getting the big man in the match awards. You're not getting the big recognition, because it's usually the top four batters will go on and score the 70 and get the man in the match, or, you know, the new ball bowlers will take the fourth and, you know, get the man in the match, where you'll come in and score 25 of 10 balls and take 2 for 25 in your four overs. It's good, but it's not the match winning, you know, you don't get put up in lights because of that, but it's the small impacts that actually, you know, benefit the team. But then, like you said, as soon as I got to Namibia, all of a sudden I was batting number 4 or 5, you know, having more time to play, being seen as the main player there, and then taking the new ball, bowling at the death. You know, you've suddenly, people start seeing you not just as a jack of all trades, master of none type of thing, you know, but as a genuine all-rounder. And, you know, like I said, from there, once that happened, you know, it really elevated my status as an all-rounder in, you know, in the leagues. And last year, I never thought that I'd actually get to the stage where I had to start turning down gigs, because it was just, you have too much going on. But you know, it really got to a stage where, you know, you, I don't know how it happened, but all of a sudden you're just in high demand, and you know, that must just be because people start seeing you as a different type of player and not just that bits and pieces anymore.
The other thing I thought was quite interesting is you kind of became Dwayne Bravo. You kind of became, not only were you playing in almost as many leagues, but you know, I'm interested in this, whether this was a conscious effort, but you do become, it's very hard to find a person with batting skill, even less than yours, but even at your level, who can also bowl at the death. So, you know, that's why Chris Morris was always paid so much money, because that bowling at the death is not a skill that that many players have at all. But if you can add even a little bit of batting, and obviously you added a lot more, when do you decide that the death is kind of something that suits you, and how do you work that out? And I wonder how much being a batter helps with that, in the same way it might for someone like Chris Morris and Dwayne Bravo, because they kind of know where they don't want the ball to be at that time of the innings. Is that how it works for you as well?
Yeah, so it definitely helps with me being a death hitter when it comes to bowling, because, you know, I always put myself in my shoes and I'll say, okay, if I'm facing myself now, what would I expect? What would I want and what wouldn't I want? And then you take it from there. So you're always trying to be a step ahead of the batsman in that sense. And then the other side of it is, like, I kind of just sat down one day and I was like, I felt that the art of death bowling had kind of gone away for a while. You know, there was the time when Malinga came in and bowled six Yorkers at the death, and that was it, you know. But then people started going away from Yorkers and just started bowling changes of pace, and, you know, it was about the mystery slower balls and the back of the hands and all of that. And people kind of went away from the old traditional death bowling, which kind of suited me a little bit, because my forte was more about changes of pace and, you know, being more subtle with things and, you know, slipping in one or two Yorkers over there. But, you know, it was mainly always about changing of pace, going to the wicket and deceiving the batsman. And so as the T20 game evolved from guys going away from the Yorkers and going to change of pace, that is when I came in, and, you know, the whole change of pace thing wasn't that prevalent back then. Now you kind of gotten used to the guys with the change of pace. Now they're going back again to the Yorker side of it again. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the game keeps evolving like that. And I was just fortunate that at that stage it evolved to the skill that I kind of was doing the whole time.
You're now, you know, IPL level player, you know, World Cup, you're preparing for the World Cup, you're heading over to Oman soon, and then you'll head over to the World Cup with Namibia again. I don't want to say it feels accidental, because obviously you've done all the work, but there's no way when you were 20 or 21, you were thinking that you would have played for two international teams and played in, you know, the biggest league in the world and all these sorts of things. You know, you've got this podcast, which is quite reflective podcast, like, and clearly on, you know, listening to you here, you know, I could see now why you would want to do a podcast like that. But what stage are you entering in your career, and what are you starting to think about now? You know, I'm assuming you're not planning on going back and being an auditor.
No, that part of my life is kind of gone, which is a pity, because I kind of enjoyed the whole auditing thing. You know, when I was studying it, I found it interesting, but obviously my first passion was always playing cricket, and, you know, I wouldn't change it for the world. For what's next, I'm not sure, to be honest. I never saw myself to be the type of person that would go into coaching or anything like that. But as I've gotten older now, you kind of naturally gravitate towards, you know, younger guys coming to you, chatting about experience and, you know, helping out and mentoring the younger guys. And I kind of find myself enjoying that side of it a bit, you know, passing on a bit of knowledge. And, I mean, I don't know how it's happened, but I've played over 600 international games now. You know, if you had to tell the 20-year-old kid back then he'd play over 600, you know, cricket games professionally, he would laugh at you. But, you know, so I've kind of got a little bit of experience now what's going on. And guys have tapped into that over the last couple of seasons. And I've enjoyed that side of it. So, no, I'm not saying that I'm finished. You know, I've still got this fire inside of me to keep going, keep performing. And, you know, I still have a couple of years left in me of franchise cricket, definitely. But then it's definitely a side that I like to explore afterwards, you know, whether it's consulting, mentoring or something like that. It's something that I've also, again, you know, everything in life, it seems like you don't plan for it. You kind of just fall into it. And, you know, for me, I never planned playing professional cricket. I kind of fell into it. And then, you know, I never planned to be a coach, but I've kind of also fallen into that side of it now also. And, you know, generally that's when the good things happen. So I'll take it a day at a time. But at this stage, my full focus is still on, you know, being that match winner, playing, you know, franchise tournaments and just contributing to whichever team I play for as much as I can.
And what about, you know, we talked about the family and everything at the start, but, you know, you clearly know what it's like to come, I mean, you know, from a less of a cricket background, as in, you know, so many of the big South African players obviously come from the big schools and sort of, you know, are seen early on and play in
traditional sports schools.
Yeah. And you have that background, you know, and yourself and you know, LB Morkel and Morne Morkel are two others that have come from that different background. Do you feel like you have something to give, like from a community sort of aspect back in South Africa, or of, you know, maybe making, you know, helping out those sorts of people who aren't necessarily always in that sort of private school pathway system?
I think it's everybody's responsibility to, you know, to give back to the community and to give back to the sport, really. I mean, you know, this sport has given me everything in life, really. You know, it's given me the opportunity to see the world. It's given me the opportunity to meet so many fantastic people, you know, learn different cultures. So, you know, it's kind of, you've got to be kind of a heartless person just to turn away from that and not give back a little bit, you know. And, you know, coming from South Africa, there's so much, there's so much poverty and so much underprivilege going on here that you kind of, again, ignorant if you don't know that. And you know, if you don't want to give back to that, then, again, it says a lot about your character also. So, again, I don't know where the future holds, you know, what's where I'm going to end up. But it's definitely something that, you know, I would want to help other people out whichever way that I can, whether it's just, you know, I'm not saying setting up an academy or going into schools or coaching, but, you know, there's a lot of other ways, just, you know, having chats, speaking to people. You can just give somebody an hour of your time, you know, that could change their life, change their perspective about things. You know, so that's something that also, you know, I plan on doing. But I'm also that type of person that while I'm playing, I just want to focus 100% on playing. And then when I'm finished with that, then I'll filter off into all the smaller different things. But I'd like to not get too distracted with too many other things. I just want to focus all my energy on what I have to do at the moment. And then once that's finished, then you kind of, you know, filter out to all the other things.
Last question. Obviously, you're doing the podcast, Hitman for Hire, as you said at the top. Why did you feel the need to do that? Like, you know, it's the sort of thing that, you know, sometimes people do after their career. And I know, you know, we see players like, you know, Tamal Mills and others who kind of, you know, dabble with that. And, you know, Ashwin and Usman Khawaja have their own podcasts and everything. But those are, again, very different. This feels like you had something to say, but why did this all come together?
Yeah, so it actually wasn't my idea to start off with. It was you know, it's Sam Kerr's idea who I
no nice things about Sam on this podcast, please.
So he was actually the brainchild behind it. And you know, I've worked with Sam at Sussex. You know, he started off at Sussex when I was there, and I've known him for a long time. And you know, it was kind of his idea. And as soon as he proposed the idea, I thought it would be fantastic. And you know, for me, it was more about people always see the glitz and the glamour about, you know, franchise cricket. I've had so many people say, oh, you're living the dream, you know, you're staying in five-star hotels, you're flying business class all over the world, you get to play cricket, you know, you're living the dream. It's like, yeah, I am. I won't argue with you there. But there's a lot of other things that go on behind the scenes. You know, you don't know what it's like to have those insecurities of knowing that if you don't perform in this tournament, you might not get picked up again. Every single game you play is an audition for your next game, for your next tournament. You know, there's so much insecurities about that. You know, there's so much time you spend away from your family. You try and spend 4 weeks in a hotel during COVID where you can't leave the room or you can't do anything. You know, you get to the first time you get to Pakistan and you play in the PSL there, as safe as it is, there's still all of the security measures that goes on there. I've never seen so many security and guns in my life. You know, it's all these small little things that people don't see that goes on behind the scenes of franchise cricket. And I thought it's important for people to know that. And I thought it would be quite interesting for people to see that other side of it. You know, we don't just focus on the cricket side of it. There's also, you know, just general life and what goes on behind the scenes in the franchise circuit. And You know, I found once I started talking about it and once we started doing the episodes, it kind of almost became therapeutic also for me to be able to speak to people about these things and for people to hear our perspective. And, you know, hopefully people can, you know, if they listen to it, they can almost just understand, and I don't want to say sympathize with, you know, the franchise cricketer, because, you know, that's not what I'm saying at all, but just more understand why there are people who have to have mental health breaks, who have to step away from the game a little bit. You know, there are a lot of pressures that you might think is small, but for them it compounds and compounds throughout the season. And then all of a sudden they're stepping away, taking a mental break, and people are like, oh, he's spoiled. He doesn't know what he's got. And you know, hopefully this can just shed a little bit of light on what actually goes on behind the scenes.
It always reminds me, there's a line in a Cypress Hill song that says, it's a dream job, but it's still a job. Right. And you still have to deal with all those other things. And it's, we know, you know, how lucky you are and how much it's transformed your life, but you still have to strap up your knee on a day when your knee's hurting because you know that you don't have a contract in 3 months' time. And, you know, you probably, especially right at the moment, you're in that moment where you're like, I have to cash in these next couple of years. Everyone knows who I am now. Whereas for years I was playing when everyone didn't.
Yeah. So like, as I'm sitting here at the moment, I'm unemployed. Until September, I'm unemployed. So, you know, you try waking up in the morning and knowing that you have to go to the gym and you have to do all of the work, but you don't know what you're doing it for because technically speaking, you don't have a job at the moment. You know, that's quite daunting. And then the 100th draft happened last week and then you don't get picked up in that. And then you're like, yeah, okay, there are other tournaments that are taking place that you could get picked up in. But, you know, it's still that thought in the back of your mind. You know, did I do well enough to get picked up? You know, are they every single year? There's new guys coming through who's playing in the circuit. You know, there's always those insecurities in the back of your mind, and you know, those are the things that people don't know that they don't understand. They think it's just, well, pitch up, sign for the big money, and there you go.
Thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
No, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Baram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recording. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, you will need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up great clips from your podcast chats and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.